Florence Nightingale, a retraction. This is my fault if we... I don't know about this, but I think I was the person who discovered, as I thought, that Florence Nightingale invented the pie chart. Am I wrong, Flash?
You are wrong, John, I'm afraid, on this occasion. It's true to say she was a noted statistician, but she did not invent the pie chart. It was being used by a man named William Playfair, who was a Scots engineer, and he used it... at least 20 years, or about 20 years before Florence Nightingale was born. However, she did use pie charts in her work to demonstrate and to agitate for, better conditions in hospitals and so forth. So she used them but didn't invent them.
Okay, well, I've got two things to say about this. I don't necessarily accept this retraction. Well, I do, actually. It's a very good piece of research. Well done. But it rather raises the question of what does invention mean? Oh. I mean, as long as she wasn't copying it off somebody else, if she invented it off her own bat, do you think she knew about this William Playfair bloke?
I think she did. Well, my impression is that she did, because she was interested in statistics as a study. You know, she was a founder member of the Statistical Society and so forth.
But that's humble pie. I definitely
retract that. Principle, though, isn't it? That if it's like Leibniz and Newton, I mean, if it's independent sort of invention, then it's you can say that it's perfectly possible for two people to invent something at the same time or hugely distant points in time if they had no knowledge of the other's work.
Well, that's why you get Nobel Prizes given to... You have there's a kind of morphic resonance, isn't there, in inventions that quite often people completely independently discover the same thing. But we think, anyway, this is already known about, so that's a website mistake. That's my fault. However... One thing that is interesting is it's rather this very QI thing. If there's one thing people know about Florence Nightingale, is that she was a great nurse, right?
She was a great statistician.
No, she was her father was very forward-looking for his time, and he taught both his girls maths and various other subjects, which would not have been normal in those days when they'd be expected to draw and play the piano and know how to order servants around and so on. So he was very forward-looking. She had a sister called Parthenope. Was that in the show?
No, it wasn't.
Okay, so here's an interesting thing. She was the first woman ever to be called Florence.
Yeah, Florence was a boy's name.
It was a boy's name, exactly, after the city.
That's good, yeah.
And her sister was called Parthenope, which is, oddly enough, the Greek name for Naples. So it's Florence and Naples, he called his daughters. So he was forward-looking, but slightly eccentric. It'd be rather like calling a girl Brian or something like that today, so it's a very, very odd thing to do. But the fact that she was in her lifetime a much better mathematician than she ever was a nurse. She was only at Scutari for certainly less than a year. I think it was only about 9 months. I think she got ill and was sort of invalided home. And then, as the notes say here, she spent over 50 years pretty much confined to her bedroom with having the vapors and generally being ill and so on and corresponding with all sorts of people.
Yes,
we've got breaking news on that.
Well,
actually,
it's not breaking news, but the truth about her sojourn between the sheets might be darker than we suspect. The diary entries for 1850 show she was plagued by insomnia prompted by an unnamed enemy. And Tom Hodgkinson, editor of The Idler, author of How to Be Idle, is convinced that the enemy is the curse of all bed-bound slackers.
Which is?
Self-pleasuring. Can I give you a few diary extracts just to try and persuade you to this?
I certainly wish you would.
March the 15th. God has delivered me from the greatest offence and the constant murder of all my thoughts. June the 7th. But this long moral death, this failure of all attempts to cure, I think I have never been so bad as this last week. June the 17th, after a sleepless night physically and morally ill and broken down, I am a slave, glad to leave Athens. I have no wish on earth but sleep. June the 18th, I had no wish, no enemy. I longed but for sleep. My enemy is too strong for me. Everything has been tried. All is in vain.
Well, I'll have some of what she's having.
June the 24th, my enemy let me go and I was free. June the 29th, four long days of absolute slavery. June the 30th.
Four long days of slavery.
I cannot write a letter, can do nothing. July the 1st, I lay in bed and called on God to save me.
This is extraordinary. Who did this research?
This is from her diaries, and this was Joe, but this is...
Was this in The Idler?
Yeah, she was in bed for 54 years and she couldn't stop pleasuring herself. As Justin Pollard says, it's one way to recover from a bad war. think it's a magnificent premise for a porn
film.
It'd
be wonderful. We think past casting Britney Spears.
That's a very, very good indeed.
One other interesting thing is Matt Coward, one of our other star researchers, said that she was the first, one of the first people to do product placement. She described OXO as the perfectly invaluable in nursing the sick and wounded during the Crimean War, which is a very rare thing for some public figure to do, to pick a commercial product and say, you should use this.
That's fantastic. So OXO was invented in the Crimean War or before the Crimean War?
It's possibly before the Crimean War, but it took off after Florence, you know, when she's a cup of tea in one hand and dot, dot, dot in the other.
Calm down, Fleshy. Calm down. Go on. Take a nap. No, don't do. Don't go in. Don't get into bed. Yes.
I shall retire to my bed. It's an interesting idea, though, isn't it? There must have been lots of it. All those fainting heroines. It gives you a whole sort of another side to 19th century fiction, doesn't it? I need to go and lie down. I bet you do.
This is not just a porn film. This is a series, and we get Andrew Davis to write it.
Andrew Davis would be very pleased with this information.
The second retraction, I'm not sure if this is a retraction, actually, but we had a little gimmick going about looking for sepia in the show. And the sepia came, we asserted, when there was a brownish-coloured picture put up on the screen, and we said that the sepia colour in that came from sepia dye, which comes from cuttlefish ink. There's a bit of a debate about that. I think there's something to be said for this, but it seems that the sepia used in photographic processes was not obtained from cuttlefish ink, but was named after the ink that was used in just simply for drawing and painting that was made from cuttlefish ink. So the sepia in the photograph was perhaps not from a cuttlefish. So that might have been an erroneous steer on our part.
Gerontius Grumpus wrote to us about the question
very
of
very fine, upstanding poster.
Very fine, upstanding, very learned chap. We stated, I think, the lens of the human eye is made of calcium carbonate, the same stuff that that Rennies and Settlers are made of, and that is my fault. I didn't say that, actually, but in the way that the notes were written, it was meant to refer to the lens of the eyes of fish, which are made of calcium carbonate, because it said the bones of fish and eyes, and in the business of Stephen reading it out, we somehow got it slightly back to front. Very sorry about that. If we've misled anybody.
Custard.
Yeah, we had this question about, to which the answer is this is an explosion in a custard factory. And when I went in to take my son to school the following day, the chemistry master there said he'd watched the show and that actually we'd missed the point, which was that that reaction we show on the screen is actually simply respiration. Or at least it's the oxidation of glucose. The term explosion in a custard factory, which Helen used, I think she used because that's the demonstration that's normally done in schools. They use custard powder to make that explosion and they write the reaction up in that form. But actually, that kind of explosion isn't limited to sugar dust, which is what you get in custard powder, but virtually anything organic can explode in that way in the right conditions. Right, so on to bonobos, yes.
Well, these very exciting, almost chimpanzees, where they're obviously a... Are they technically a... They're not really even a subspecies. They were for a long time called pygmy chimpanzees, but we're now pretty sure that they're a complete and separate species.
Yes, they are a separate species.
Different behavioural characteristics.
They're called paniscus, whereas the common chimp is called troglodytes.
Yes, and they were only found, identified definitely as a species in 1929.
And the other thing is they're not pygmies, really. They're about the same size, in fact. Yes.
But they do. They have an interesting... They became very popular, particularly in the 70s, because, the bonobos sort of run things rather like a sort of feminist hippie collective. So there's almost every problem issue is solved by sex in bonobos. They have, male, female, 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 male, male, adult, child. So it's... Sex is a sort of universal social solvent and a means of communication.
Well, good for them.
Almost anything that arouses the interest of a bonobo will end up in bonobo sex. And they've got, like chimps, they have enormous testicles. This is the great difference between, the difference between chimps and gorillas. Gorillas famously have very, very, very small penises. And it's because the... Gorillas have a harem system where a very dominant silverback male will have a group of females. So he doesn't. Once you've got the, once you've got that sorted out, you don't really need to, you know, you don't need to prove yourself any further. Whereas as chimpanzees and bonobos are having sex all the time with lots of different partners, big testicles, sperm warfare, you need to have lots and lots of sperm to make sure that you have the best possible chance of raising your own
rather than somebody else. Thanks for sharing that with us, John. The other thing that's interesting we mentioned in the show is that bonobos use the missionary position for sex.
Yes.
They're either unique or at least nearly unique in that respect. And we just looked a bit into where that expression, missionary position, came from. And apparently it's first cited in the Kinsey Report in 1948. And the sexual behavior in the human male in respect of anthropological studies in New Guinea. And the context is not the one which people normally assume it is. It's not that missionaries went out to these places and tried to force the practice onto the natives. But in Kinsey's opinion, anyway, it is that the natives observed missionaries doing it that way and made fun of it. They called it the missionary.
The missionary, that's very good. Yeah. My last chimpanzee stroke bonobo fact is that human beings have more hair follicles than they do.
Than chimpanzees?
Yeah.
Don't say so stupid, how can we?
It's just true. It's I'm afraid, well
attested. More follicles, but less hair.
We have much, much, much finer hair.